I just really wanted to ask you about the kind of deity figure that you mentioned, because I've always had it that in Buddhism there is no god as such, and it sounds very close to the Judeo-Christian god.
Lots of gods in Buddhism.
Well, I mean like an overarching god.
Yeah, there's lots of them. And he's a Brahma, which means one of the top rank. I think they're in fact in that culture. So significantly, the Buddha has him going down on his bended knees.
Describe.
Yeah. So it's clearly the gods are not the top. And gods, spirits, cosmic forces, they seem to crop up throughout all different cultures in their development, in their consciousness, in the way they experience consciousness. And at a certain point they seem to fade out of people's consciousness or ways of describing things, when you tend towards much more of the psychology and less of the cosmology.
What was the name of Brahma?
This one, Brahma Saham Pati. Pati is father. Saham means all. Father of all. I don't think it's, it's quite, not quite Jehovah, but he's occupying a similar sort of place.
Yeah.
But he's not vengeful like Jehovah. He doesn't kind of smite and beat people up like Jehovah. And he's not jealous and, like Jehovah was. He's just sort of, just maintaining awareness of this is the cosmos, what's happening, in that nice, quite peaceful configuration. He's obviously concerned for the welfare of the world, that's why he asked the Buddha to teach, which is nice. But the scriptures always make it quite clear the Brahmas may be big, but they're not enlightened. They're still very much stuck in the cosmos. If we interpret it psychologically in the sense that's the kind of that's the quality of awareness when it's in a very broad empathic state. So if we look at cosmos as consciousness, so you can get all kinds of details occurring within consciousness, but then you get to the Brahma Loka, you get more like span and senses. Consciousness is span, like, this is what we're with, before we get into the activities, this is what's happening. So this is the sense of a very wide consciousness that's just tuned into, what's going on here, and then realization of some enlightenment happening there, and wow, let's, tune into that.
John, you talked of body and deathbed. At one point you made a quotation from Pali. The word pasti.
Pasti.
Yes.
To touch.
How do you repeat that?
Well, the quotation is touches the deathless with one's body. The word touches is Pali word pas. PHASUTI. Pasuti. And sometimes that expression is used, one touches the immaterial deliverances with one's body. So someone who is on the path is considered someone who understands like the five indriyas of spiritual faculties. Someone who's called aseka, beyond training, in other words they've completed, is someone who touches these in his own body. They've come to completion in his body. Now, you know, and it's not explained. So, you know, what bodies do these spiritual faculties come to completion in? Yeah, I guess my sense would be this is in your subtle body or your embodied presence or the body, you know, that we experience like an embodied awareness. Deathless itself can be problematic because, of course, everybody dies, including the Buddha, in one sense. Bodies die, sense faculties fade and disappear. Does that mean the Buddha is immortal? Or is it that some deathless in the Brahminical tradition meant a sense of something that knows no boundaries, no boundaries of fear, no boundaries of loss, no boundaries of separation? Was what death means to us is, oh, that's the end, I won't, you know, I'm lost, I'm gone, everything I've been with is finished, there's alarm, there's fear, there's separation. Deathless is, there's none of that, there's no fear, there's no separation, there's no loss. There's none of the defences and the worries and concerns and the grief that occur when we contemplate or sense death. So it's a sort of boundless awareness that doesn't react to that.
When you were saying about getting to what's sort of underneath the, like, the sort of layers of, like, what's at the bottom of it, what's, and I found when I was doing that and I was sort of labels coming to me, and I was thinking, well, I'm sort of used to more just trying to feel something without labelling so much. Or am I then just like the labels come up and then I'm sort of labelling the next thing as that, or I don't know, I'm not sure what I'm trying to say, but I was trying to, I don't know if it's,
go easy on the labelling, because it can be that you're almost overdoing it and perhaps jumping to conclusions.
Yeah,
you know, you're pre-labelling,
yeah.
Before it's. So you just want enough sketchy sense of feels, charge. You know, first things we feel a certain sense of something seems more charged, more significant, more. You know, more reactive, you know, might feel sense of something, you know, within the field of awareness that seems quite activated. And then just staying with that, letting it. Sometimes you never really know what these things are. You just sort of do almost like just things that come up and dissolve as you come into them. You may sense them in parts of your body. And sometimes it's very clear they're associated with an emotion arises along with them, and then it becomes quite more clear what that is. I wouldn't hurry it though. Don't try to get a label if one doesn't pop up. So it's rather more imaginative, you know, the way that imagination works. Pause and then comes back. When it's right, you get a very strong sense of, oh yeah, that's ringing bells. Often very simple. And it can be, you know, even when you're doing that, you might begin to recognize, maybe I'm trying too hard. That's what's happening. Trying to get labeling done, trying too hard. That's the bit that. So it could be in the way that we practice. It's quite holistic to see it's both, you know, that which I'm practicing on and the way that I'm practicing. See what I mean?
Earlier that breath is a sankhara. Can you explain that in a bit more detail, what that means exactly?
Well, breathing in and out is a sankhara. Breathing in and out, as you clearly, is an activity, isn't it? It's not a thing, it's a anapanasati, breathing in and out. So it's definitely a process of some, you know, movement, change. So one aspect of sankhara is it's got a dynamic in it, it's energetic. Then when we say we're breathing in and out, well, what is breathing in and out? Is it the air? You know, the air is not breathing in and out. The air is being breathed in and out. It's not breathing. The air doesn't breathe. Does the nose breathe in and out? Well, it's part of it. Do the lungs breathe in and out? They're part of it. But recognizing that they themselves, dead people don't breathe in and out. They've still got noses and lungs. So that's not innate to them. There's something happening in the life force that's breathing in and out. So it's dynamic. In this case, it's embodied. This sankhara is embodied. It's that which causes breathing in and out to happen. Monitors it, programs it, governs it, steers it, experiences it. Breathing in and out, breathing in and out. What does breathing in and out? Well, we could say the diaphragm does, but obviously, you know, if you're dead, it doesn't. So there's something happening there that causes the diaphragm to pull and subside. And it's not just the diaphragm, but chest cavity opens, throat opens, nostrils tend to pull in, and then at a certain point where it's completely breathing in and out, in my experience the first movement is not exactly a movement, but like a switch comes on somewhere behind the nose, and then there's a signal that runs down. It might be something to do with the vagus nerve, I don't know. Causes the subsiding, because the subsiding is not like a push, like the diaphragm pushing. It's everything going too. Yeah. Now, what can do that? That's not a muscular action. It's a muscular deaction. You see what I mean? Muscular release. So a signal seems to occur that says, "Okay, release." But it's not like you collapse. So there's a graduated quality to that. So it's quite a carefully held, graduated release. Yeah? So that, there's intelligence there. Something is monitoring that and holding it and carefully, so we don't just gasp, suck, and then, you know, expire. It's gradually held, and it's, if you like, all of the whole of the body seems to cooperate in that. Rather like, you know, how the blood gets passed around the body. It's not just the heart. The veins and the arteries tighten and get those vortexes going that send the blood through the system. So we tend to, you know, assume that, say, breathing is just done by one piece, but it's actually everything in the body. It senses it, contributes it to it, helps to moderate that, so it's a smooth process. Now when it is really handed over to the body to do it, that's exactly what it is. It's very smooth, involuntary. You know, you don't have to do it. It's smooth, it's involuntary, it's calming because of that. Because I don't have to do it, it's relaxing. Because it's smooth, it's calming. And so that's great for meditation. You know. Except when we try to do it. When you try too hard to do mindfulness of breathing, then we plant a mental agitation on top of that. That can be very quite difficult, you know. Because it's involuntary, the mind isn't specially interested in it, because it doesn't, the thinking mind doesn't have to organise it, so it doesn't breathing. It's happened to somebody else, you know. I'm busy calculating da 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 da. Breathing, that happens somewhere else. It's not my issue. So it's very difficult for the mind to really turn towards breathing because it's got nothing to do. And the thinking mind finds it difficult. The mind that's centered around the thought, the progress, the meanings, the knowledge, the all that stuff, finds it difficult. But the heart finds it quite pleasant. You know, it's like lying on your back on the beach. Nobody's bothering me. Life's good. Enjoy, you know. And why the Buddha recommended it, said this is very enjoyable, and it's even good for your health, because it's like your system just starts to relax and be refreshed, and this vitality is then flowing around the body, and the mind picks that up as an emotional tone of, now you're being held, because it's in what you don't have to do it, so it's doing you. Something that's warming and generous and works perfectly well by itself. Wonderful. You can relax into this, and because of that your mind will enter samadhi. Yeah. So that's the idea. But of course, to get into the body and to let the body come to the body is actually quite constricted. Or numbed or blocked because of shock and tension and things of this nature, or just being, because we spend a lot of time in rather disembodied states, see what I mean, yeah? Looking at screens and books and stuff, so we spend a lot of time disembodied, so there's quite a disconnect between the body, between the thinking mind and the body. So, and that results in a certain sterility of heart. The heart is kind of flat and bored and sterile, and it's only when we can bring that back together again in a careful, and the attitude I suggest is one of, you know, careful, no hurry, no pressure, enjoy, get in there and really try to enhance your body awareness, and then, but when it comes there, then the heart will feel happy. And then the thinking mind will then begin to calm down within that. And so, but because, you know, that the all these three sankhara sympathize with each other or connected to each other, particularly the chitta sankhara, which is, we might say, the imagination, the perceptions, the memories, the feelings, the emotions, that aspect of mind, we call it heart, that's very much in sympathy with the body, because they're both affective. In other words, they're the ones that jump.
Mm. Yeah.
They're the ones that feel happy. Brain thinking doesn't feel happy or unhappy. It doesn't feel. It's not associated with that. So what is felt in the bodily sense will be felt in the heart sense. So if the bodily sense becomes full and free and open, the heart will feel that way too. That's why it's there, you know. Is that helpful?
Yeah, very helpful.
I'm wondering, why do you call it a sankhara though? What does that actually mean about the breath?
It means it's activated. It's programmed.
Does that make it a neutral sankhara in terms of...
It's ethically neutral, morally neutral.
Mm.
It's compounded, created, so it's not unconditioned. It's conditioned. And it... Sankharas form. So it forms our body. You know, so in the direct experience of your body, not what you see with your eyes, but you sense your body, that quality of body that you sense through the body will be very much affected through by the breathing. The breathing in ways forms your sense of your body grows big, or grows small, grows bright, grows calm, grows still, and grows measureless. Whereas the thing you see with your eye doesn't do that. So it's dynamic, it can change, and it gives you a form, subtle form. Mostly it gives you the sense of being here. Your mind doesn't give you a sense of being here. It gives you two senses. It gives you the sense of what you're feeling, and it gives you a sense of what you're doing. Yeah. So the heart is how I'm feeling, how I am with something, if I'm comfortable with it, or displeased, or frightened, or happy. Yeah. And the thinking mind tells you what you should be doing, or are doing, or how to do it. But none of them tell you where you are, directly. So, you know, you can be, when you're in a train of thought, you don't know where you are. You're in Thoughtsville, you're in panic, you're in planning, you're in nostalgia, you're in whatever, you're in those states, but you're not here. So that's why we lose ground, we lose groundedness through not being in touch with the body. And then we get overwhelmed. Puzzled? Taking it in?
Yeah, I'm taking it in, but it's kind of like...
Building it up.
Open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, what's the sense of... For example, the sense of overwhelmed is bowled off my feet. Too much going on. Help. You know, where's the ground? Where's the anchoring? Where's the mooring post? What can I hold on to? When that occurs, we've lost embodiment. So the simple remedy for that is getting to your feet, your body, stand still, hold something, and you feel a bit, oh, right, here I am, you know. So that groundedness is very important for giving one a sense of, like a... where you can discharge these powerful emotional and psychological impressions, because we're here, and then the stuff can blow through, but we've got a sort of a a mooring post. That's again why mindfulness of the body is so important to cultivate, not just in meditation but in general daily life. You walk down the street, try to be aware of your feet as you walk. When you go into the tube, down the stairs, be aware of the footsteps on the stairs as you go down the stairs. Then you don't get lost in the adverts, you don't get into the kind of tremendous tumult of the crowd and this sort of sense of the huge energies that you can stay where you are and you feel calm because of that. Visual form. Without it, we're just like ghosts on the wind, blown around.
I'm not sure if this is a question or just a kind of nebulous thing that I'm aware of a lot of the time, sort of getting back to the very beginning of this retreat and talking about all of the things that we do just to distract ourselves and that occupy us. And sometimes I feel this, not talking about distraction, but just kind of general human endeavor and this tension around motivation. Like, what is, why, since so much of our motivation, I think, comes from narcissism or from wanting to belong or from wanting to, or from wanting things sometimes. And then sometimes when we can maybe be released from some of that, I just sometimes struggle with the idea of, well, what is healthy motivation and why? Because if you take it to its logical absurdity, it's kind of like, why do anything? You know, if we can just, if our being is sufficient, I mean, in the sense of, I think, doing no harm, yes, but the world functions, you know, they're, we depend on so many people doing things. I don't know if this is making any sense or ringing any bells, but it's like sometimes this is also happens to me in a sense of, in terms of creative endeavor, and I used to be very motivated in that sense, and sometimes I feel like I've lost that motivation, and part of it is a kind of, what's the point? Why make more? And then some of it is just to do with where motivation comes from.
Yeah, well, you know, motivation is for one's welfare and the welfare of others. So there's that primal sympathy, anukampa, for the release of suffering, for the diminution of stress, and for the bringing forth supportive potentials to bring that around. And maybe one question to ask, you know, when we, what's the point? Why bother? What's important is to ask the question, what do you love? What's beautiful?
Well, I think that sometimes what's happened is I find that it's easy to do things where it's you feel like you're helping someone or you're doing something loving, or whether it's caring for aging parents or for children that have difficulties or something like that. But then there's just, it's like things still have to function and turn around. And I mean, maybe it's just the thing about the world. It's like if we were all occupied just sort of looking after each other, with, you know, wouldn't that be great? But and when you say what you love, I don't know. I mean,
take it deeply. I find myself very, really not just love-like, but actually, what are really moves me is things like freedom, what helps me to include is what helps me to include more. What helps me to include more, not necessarily do more, but sympathize with more. What helps me to include more in my awareness without getting agitated. You know, actually include it in heartfulness rather than in got to do something about it or agitation. You know. And so, for example, you know, then this is the kind of subtle doing of working in the heart. So, what helps me to, you know, deepen and widen my sense of compassion and conscience? What helps me to lessen my blindness and blind consuming, So doing can be also what helps me to undo places where I'm just gobbling things up that I don't need to bother with. So that there's an ongoing motivation in that, I think. But it's not really, I mean, doing will come out of it in accordance with one's capacities to do and whether there's an openness to it. The actual manifestations in the external world are limited by one's range of how much power, influence you have, and then how much receptivity there is to it. But that's the next, that isn't something one can have so much say over, but as to whether I can stop holding grudges, stop feeling vindictive, stop blaming other people, stop feeling fed up, it's all pointless, then there's something to be done there. Yeah. Because just to stay conscious without getting depressed, I think, is quite an achievement. In some respects, you know.
But sometimes that's what it feels like, is that the more consciousness, the more desperate it seems.
Yeah. Sangweka is a Buddhist word for it, which is, means it's a sort of a sense of a compassionate sense of pathos. Likened to, you know, seeing a pond with fish in it. When the summer sun is gradually drying the pond up, you look, you think, oh dear. Sangweka. But then, you know, despond isn't useful. It doesn't support anything. And that just to shift the weight of that takes, you know, it takes some, definitely some subtle and constant doing. So what's the joyful now? You know, what's the bright, joyful thing one can touch with one's mind, or touch with one's hands, or touch with one's actions? Well, I'll do that.
You mentioned the two novices, one who been in a war situation on one hand, difficult mother. I'm just wondering, you might have answered this already, but what are the best practices for that kind of deep trauma, medical practices? And do you see a role for medication and therapy for those types of?
Well, I think so, yeah. I think when you have very heavy effects from the circumstances around you, it's pretty helpful if the circumstances around you are helpful, therapeutic. You know, so I'm not convinced that you can do it all internally in meditation. I'm not convinced of that. Maybe, but you know, my sense is it's kind of meditative how you are with other beings. When you see someone, what happens? When you see people who are bigger than you, what happens? When you see people who people argue with you, what happens? You know, so you're actually contemplating how you're getting triggered. You know, as for example, in that case, you know, those people had noticed what happens when this fellow sits next to the other guy. You know, can I actually handle that charge, you know, as here, and find some ground, find some space, breathe in and out, contemplate, investigate that, then yeah, maybe that would work. But for some cases, getting that potential there is quite a long haul and might need some help with it. Just because when we come to these very difficult, painful places, the mind will generally bounce off. Either it will go into reaction, deeply stirred reactive states where we start, you know, blaming ourselves, blaming others, or getting angry or collapsing. Whereas the mind doesn't stay stable, it just splinters. Or it will just distract. Oh, you know, suddenly you're off watching something else happen, you know, the mind just bounces off. Holding it steady in the presence of that disturbance, that's what we're looking at as a possibility of letting that feeling be felt, and then felt, moves through, discharges, release, complete, finishes. But, yeah. So one might need some help with that. You know, in fact, who doesn't? Quite mind, it's not theoretical. The Buddha said there's the two fundamental supports. One is your own deep attention, and the other is spiritual friendship, the spiritual friend. Now, you can translate spiritual friend in a number of ways, but it basically means you're getting your message from somebody else who's saying, okay, Jack, okay, yeah, well, let's do this, or go for a walk, or, you know, you're getting it from outside. And essentially, the two are doing the same thing, but one represents the case when your own deep attention can do that grounding, that earthing, that, and the other is when the other person helps to catalyze that in you. Now, make no mistake about it, whether it's somebody else or not, somebody else present or not, It's what they're helping you to do in yourself. That, you know, if they're listening to you, that's helping you. You're still doing it. It's still happening in you. It's not happening anywhere else. Yeah. But the of course, when it's coming from outside, that person outside is not fracturing and agitating like one's own mind is. So the act is that grounding presence that helps to send that signal through the body. Perhaps the fundamental signal is you're okay. You know, when you speak to someone, it's just rather, oh no, how do you feel? That already has a kind of therapeutic effect.
Talked about kind of self-acceptance, and you said there is nothing wrong with you. It sometimes feels to me that with this tradition that people feel that that's like the end of the path, and that it's not enough, it seems to me, simply to accept yourself. You have to look at how you relate to other people, how you're behaving towards other people, how to live better ethically. I mean, just in the other spiritual tradition in which I practice, you know, now's a very important time when we are looking at ourselves, and it's not necessary to beat yourself up about, but to actually think, where did I miss the mark? You know, how could I do better in the coming year?
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with you, it's just your behaviour's all messed up. But we can't deal with messed up behaviour from a messed up state of being. You know, so in a way, what you're saying is absolutely right. But then from somewhere we're a bit more grounded, and I can, oh, that wasn't so good, was it? Why wasn't it any good? Instead of just going into the other people don't like it, it created that and feel it. Ooh, you know that. And then, you know, the Buddhist sense is this was not worthy of me. You idiot, but this was not, I'm bigger than this. This was not worthy of me. You know, there's a healthy self-impression that sees this contracted, sour, manipulative, you know, whatever it was, being in the behaviour realm as being, that's not, I'm bigger than that. Where you see, people tend to identify with their behaviour rather than identify with the healing of their behaviour. They become, instead of the patient, they become the disease. It's also not possible to you know, have a state of you know, really sensing, not just, you know, adding this slogan, I am all right, but actually really sensing it. If you're deliberately acting in unskillful ways, it's not going to happen. You know, it just becomes another empty slogan. So once one discerns in that place, this was unskillful, then we investigate what happened there, where did ignorance catch hold, where was the triggering, that's where it is. And then the Buddha says this is called progress, to understand one's transgressions. And then we do need that very fine, you know, eye, handle, touch, to really sense the bits where if we get caught, get snagged, go off the track, as it were.